I'll serve as moderator to try to keep it a little in order, try to get folks who haven't had a chance to speak yet to get their chance before others who have spoken get on again, and maybe try to be somewhat focused. I'll try my very best not to participate as a conversationalist this evening. That's not always easy for me, as I've told you before. And then I will watch the time so that at 10 o'clock we'll break off, and those who want to continue after that can surely do that on their own. One of the reasons, a number of reasons were given to me why suggesting that discussion of feminism be made. One specifically was to share how much progress has been made. And another specifically was to share that no progress has been made whatsoever. including the note that I got tonight from somebody, a quote from Copenhagen, UN conference in the regarding the decade for women that was begun in 75, and a report indicating worldwide that it looks to them like not only has there hasn't been progress, but that women are worse off in the world than they were 10 years ago, or 5 years ago at least, or when that, whatever that was, 19, I guess it was 75, it was 5 years ago. Others indicated that they wanted to talk about this in terms of the church, and others wanted to talk about it in terms of the world. There's both of those there. And I know that there's difficulty in defining what feminism is. That people have differing ideas. So maybe along the line we're going to have to ask one another, well, what do you mean by feminism if that's what you say back and forth? I'll try to establish one, because that probably be too long a period anyway. So, with that in mind, invite you to start off with any comments. A lot about feminism. Yes, please.
I read a report the other day, an editorial in the Seattle Times, which suggested that Phyllis Schlafly is the woman in our future. And from the results of the Republican Platform Committee work this week, abandoning support for an Equal Rights Amendment, which they have supported since 1940, and the controversy surrounding the White House Conference on Families, and the suggestion in those conferences that women's place is carefully defined, most appropriately in the home. I'm concerned that there is a backlash underway that is eroding a great deal of the work that's been done in the last 10 years. Curious as to whether my fears are founded or unfounded in the opinions of others.
Okay. Trust you all heard him. Is there any response to that or other comments? Yes?
I would say in terms of the argument of whether there has been progress, no progress, or regression, is that the word I want?
Yep.
If no progress has been made, at least there's an awareness. Now, whether that's, you know, makes things any different or not, at least in my context, the awareness of some of the things that the feminist movement has tried to set forth by some of my male counterparts has produced maybe a little change in their, you know, the way they look at things. There's nothing else.
Thank you. Someone else.
I think that editorial is probably correct to a certain extent in terms of the way things seem to be moving. And from what I've read and heard and stuff. But one thing I think is frightening about it is that Phyllis Schlafly and the people who support her in her position and other people who are against feminism or anything for women are working, seem to be more and more working from a position of fear. They are afraid. They're afraid of the breakdown of the family. They're afraid of the contamination of society by various changes, and that in turn is frightening to me. if they're working from a platform of fear, because anybody who's working defensively out of fear is not going to hear anything else or see anything else, and is going to ride roughshod over a lot of people probably at the same time.
Good.
Another part of that that worries me is that people like Phyllis Schlafly and those who follow in her camp often argue out of the context of the church and call the church in as a support to the things that they believe. And it seems to me that it's exactly counter to the gospel, that it's just one more way in which we say there's a hierarchy of importance among human beings, one more way that we degrade certain parts of the creation, people within the creation. And yet when they speak, calling on the church as their authority and using scripture as their authority, sometimes that's all people need to hear to believe something. And yet the theology underneath, I think, is very poor, contrary to the gospel as I understand it.
Someone else? Yes, sir.
I think that this might be coincidental with an economic downswing. And we have to remember that this recent Illinois experience, the margin of loss was very, very close. In fact, it was expected, as I understand, that it would pass and then it failed by a vote or two.
It was up last time. Last time it was 2 votes. This time I think it was 5.
Was it? Well, whatever. It was. And I wonder if maybe the competition for jobs and the economic downswing, the temporary, I think temporary swing to conservatism, is a temporary setback. And I think we might overreact by thinking this is a reversal of the trend.
The interesting thing about the one in Illinois, just prior to that vote, there were estimated to be 250,000 people who came and demonstrated for ERA, and the labor unions were very strong in their support, which was very interesting.
Yeah. I repeat, it's possible to disagree. Not sure.
It may lead to a divorce, but it's possible.
let's narrow it down then. Maybe we'll
go.
Why, 10 years after the ordination of women, are there no women active as pastors in the North Pacific District of the American Lutheran Church? There having been one full-time, regularly assigned woman employed in a regular congregation during that 10 years, and there are several now sitting, waiting. That's the question of feminism.
Okay.
I don't know if that's just feminism. I think there's a problem in placing ministers in the Pacific Northwest with the ALC. I happen to live with a minister in Portland who's been waiting for 1.5 years for a call, and there's 20 calls open, and they know he's waiting for the call. He's a good pastor, but they just have, the bishop or whoever it is that places is having a problem, I think, with just playing that, placing people in a post. He's not the only one. There's a couple that are waiting, and the posts are open, but they're not being called, or their call isn't being issued. I don't know what it is. So I don't know if that's just feminism for that one. I think there's an internal problem.
Anyone else? Northwest District? Or ideas?
Just thinking that the example of Pacific Northwest District of the ALC, there may be internal problems in that district, but it's, in a way, it's just indicative of other places and other times where, you know, they're not having that kind of difficulty. I think it is a matter of feminism in this district. And there may also be other problems of placing people or numbers of jobs or getting openings and jobs together. But I think There is in the church generally, as I have seen, a reluctance at bottom to really believe that a woman like a man can be a pastor, period.
Well, I suppose there are problems involved. But what about this girl, this one that went to Alaska? Is she still?
No.
She got married now.
She's out of the district. She's serving in California.
Mm-hmm. But she was in Alaska for a while. Yeah.
She's the only one.
What would you say are the problems?
Why did she leave? Did she leave because she had to
Well, let's...
What do you see as being the problems? You say, I suppose there are problems. What do you see as...
I don't know. This same girl, she was second choice at our church. But the one who had first choice got it. But oh my, how nervous everybody was when they knew she was that, we had this woman for second choice. I mean, the whole of the congregation was nervous. Worried about it. They just wondered how it would be. I don't know why.
There has been a woman pastor at Emmanuel Lutheran in Tacoma. She has been there for a very short term, and I understand she's leaving.
She's gone.
There has been one tried there for about a year, I think.
I'd just like to raise the question of, maybe rather than a question, there's a statement behind it, that I see this as being as much, if not more, a problem of women for a woman pastor than a man for a woman pastor. I think sometimes we pretend that is not so.
Do y'all hear that?
Yeah. Don't the most recent statistics indicate, the most recent polls indicate that men favor ERA more than women by a few percentage points? Seems to me I've seen that recently.
I see some heads nodding. Were we skirting the question or did we try to answer the question? Because I was hearing it. Are the congregations... Specifically, it was mentioned Northwest District, LLC, but Lutheran congregations, let's remain at that at least, of the Northwest, interested, willing, open to calling women as pastors. Is that sort of what you're asking, or you were asking another question?
Yeah, this is really a perfect opportunity to shoot this stuff around, it seems to me.
Okay.
It's a non-threatening atmosphere. None of us is going to go home and spread the names of the other towns. I mean, it really is a good... I'm really interested in serious arguments against it because it seems to me to be an underground issue that it doesn't really have a face.
Well, I guess that's why getting the question clear enough so that everybody hears what the problem is. Yes.
I think that, you know, the question even goes perhaps to simpler terms than that. I think the question has to get right to the point, to the pastor level. Let's look at that in terms of the North Pacific District congregations and so on. We happen to be a congregation that is in call process.
Right.
And this subject has come before us, and we are a North Pacific District congregation. And the answer to the subject, basically by the pastor and agreed to by, I believe, call committee and others, was we are not ready for a woman pastor.
What does that mean?
What does that mean?
I want to
know what that means.
I'm not even that
scared. It's non-threatening.
I'm sorry.
What can we say? Just for clarity, I'm not asking a name now. I'm not interested in a name. When you say the pastor, who is that? Is that sort of a person serving interim or something?
No, this is for a secondary pastor.
Oh, I see.
An associate.
So you're talking about, yeah. Well, yeah, that's another aspect.
Sure, we did. And there are 3 men on the call committee and 4 women.
Maybe a good question is, what does it take to get a congregation ready then? I mean, if a congregation decides, the pastor says, we're not ready, the council agrees, we're not ready, then what do you do? How do you go about making a place ready? I mean, what is the readying process then?
Yeah, let's not try to answer them what they're thinking, but what do you think, the people here, what do you think would ready a congregation if it's true that they are? Huh? Anybody? Yeah. Well, here first.
Yeah, we went through this a year ago at Christ Lutheran in Lakewood in the North Pacific District, a congregation of 900 or thereabouts, and we tried to hire as an interim this gal that was up at Des Moines. What was her name? Nancy whatever.
Ah, Sharon.
Huh? Right here. About 6 feet from
me. Okay, you remember, is that true or false?
That's true.
All right, that's true. And there was no problem with this at all. And we wanted you very much. Mm-hmm. I don't know you from anybody. I'm not here as a shilly, am I? But we wanted her, and she wasn't available, so we hired Cy Torben down in North Hollywood, California. And now we're looking for another one, and I've suggested, not facetiously, that we ought to have a black woman quadriplegic or whatever. And I find, I find no resistance to this at all. None at all. And I think we may be blowing a little smoke here. I don't know that there is all this resistance.
So you think that it's really not true that congregations aren't ready. Is that
I only can speak for ours, but okay, I don't find that resistance at all.
Okay. Back there, and then over here, please.
I think anytime there's a change of the status quo, there's going to be a lot of waves and a lot of ripples and a lot of problems going on. Like, I can't remember who the guy was who lost as a presidential candidate primarily because he was Catholic. I know when Kennedy won as president for the first time, he very craftily, in a very good way, dodged the issue of him being Catholic and put other issues in people's minds and got that finally going to the point where he was elected president. And I think in terms of women coming into congregations as pastors, there will be a lot of people who, quote, aren't ready for that yet, or who haven't dealt with the ideas behind it. They haven't dealt with their own prejudices. And it'll be a process, and a slow process, of allowing people, or helping people, work those problems through.
Okay, thank you.
I'm going to try to shut up, but I guess I can't. It has been, this is what I think about congregations being ready. This is what I know about it. Being a woman pastor, I've been without call for 2 years. I've served two interims in two different kinds of congregations. And I also do a lot of retreats, and a lot of one morning stands and that kind of thing. And as a result, it's been my experience that it takes people about, I was joking with this at one interim congregation I served, one I was serving that I couldn't leave to go take the interim at Christ in Lakewood. One Sunday, and I said, well, how long did it take you to get used to it? About a Sunday? And about five people piped up and said half a Sunday. And that has been my experience. 99.9% of the times, if you ask someone if they want a woman to be their pastor, they say no. If you let a woman be their pastor, they say yes. And that happens just overwhelmingly. When I go and preach somewhere on a Sunday morning, just like, you know, a one-shot thing, I will, in an average-sized congregation, have between 15 and 25 people come up to me during coffee afterwards and say, I was dead set against it before this morning, and now I'm for it. And it's just, you know, that one thing, finding out that the Word of God is still preached, the church walls stayed up, the roof was still there, you know, the sacrament was administered properly and in due order, and all's well. And it's fine.
Thank you. Somebody else, please.
Well, so Nancy, to continue, what is it then? Is it just an entree into each congregation that women need, or is there something to do with the clergy, the male clergy that's already there that can help?
Oh yeah, I think that's the male clergy are a very big problem, because they won't, for example, in a conference, you know, just part of a district, if a congregation, for example, wants to call a woman pastor, you know, it's nice to have the support of the other congregations and pastors in the congregation, because it is kind of an adventuresome step, I will admit that. But and the pastors just won't give it often. Or just women clergy in need of support. There will be few pastors who will go out on a limb, they think, or to speak up for us, but few will. You know, it's a small amount. And that's really kind of frightening, I think. Because they can be doing things in their congregation to change attitude just by the way they function, to allow entry for women. Instead of continually using the totally male-dominated model of pastor that I think went away probably 10, 15 years ago anyway, and a lot are still trying to retain.
Someone else? Response? Can we go in another direction? No, we don't have to stay with the church all the time. We can, if you like. Yes?
I've
just wondering if it maybe just isn't a bad time for women clergy right now, because maybe I'm misinformed, but there are an awful lot of clergy in the different districts, male and female, without jobs right now. And I think that, I know in our congregation, we and our lead pastor are really being picky, because there are so many available. I mean, we're not just taking the first names and deciding, you know, that we get from the district on those names. We're going outside our district. We're, you know, really putting a lot of time and effort, and since there are so many available, and of course, since there are probably more men available than women, sure, they're going to get more of the calls probably. And another thing too, the experience. There's more experienced men available right now than there are women.
How do you ever get experienced though? You've never had a call?
Mm-hmm. Well, I know that's a problem right now, because there are so many available. I think, you know, male with experience that are available.
There are women with experience available also.
I think there's still, I think there is kind of an attitudinal, just a little experience I had after I worked in a parish for a year as an intern. I was single at the time, but it announced that I was getting married soon. And I had several people after that say, well, now we understand how you're going to do it. You're marrying a man who's going to be a pastor. Mm-hmm. And I had many people say to me, you'll be the best pastor's wife I've ever known.
Yep.
Because you have such a fine education. And you know. Yeah. So the attitude was still, even though I really had, they see, that's why I don't know that I agree with you, because they'd seen me in a pastoral role, all except the sacramental part. And yet the bottom line was that Martin would now be the pastor, and I would be really a top, even though I don't play the organ, a top-notch pastor's wife. And that spoke of an underlying attitude that there was still a hierarchy.
Yeah.
But there was still...
Okay. Somebody, please, Larry.
Well, it just underscores that. The seminary at which I teach is a Methodist seminary. There are quite a significant number of clergy couples, that is, mm-hmm. couples in training for clergy in the seminary. And what Susan just said is shared again and again in their experience. If they can find a congregation that will take them as a couple, invariably the man is expected to be in those roles of ministry which are highly visible and at the decisional centers. And the women are expected to be assistants to the man. And just again and again, this experience. I just want to say something about underlying attitudinal factors, because I think that that feminism enters in a large way in these issues of clergy. The Methodist Church has been ordaining women since 1958. It's a relatively long time compared with some other kind of denomination. But to this day, there are no, I mean, that's 22 years, isn't it? To this day, there are no women bishops in the Methodist Church. Hardly any women clergy in the Methodist Church who occupy what in the church is called major pulpits. There are some on staff in large Methodist churches, but they are not occupied as the head pastor. Staff. So here you have an experience of a denomination that's been ordaining women for some time, where women have experience and all those other reasons that congregations give for not preferring them, and where you still have the hierarchy very clearly intact. And that it is men that make the occupied chief positions and make the major decisions. I think the analogy is the civil rights movement. I mean, when is it, in the civil rights movement, we heard again and again, we're not ready yet. And it took the force of law. Now, the church at that point does not have that kind of vehicle, especially in a congregational system rather than an appointment system. And they weren't really, congregations weren't ready until they had them. I mean, the civil rights movement, it was the experience of having black. Doing the job that made the congregation ready.
Yeah, please. Sorry.
I'd like to ask a question for response. And it comes out of a statement that was made by my own mother who opposes, or did at that time, opposed women in the ministry. And her reason for that was she thought that men would begin to leave the church and active involvement in the church if the pastor was a woman. She apparently thought, we never discussed it at length, but she apparently thought that there would be a kind of natural process of the men leaving, the women taking over the central power positions in the church. Is that shared by anyone else here?
I've heard it, but it seems to me that men have already left the church. That maybe they'll come back.
I think there would be good evidence that in the Black Baptist churches that are led by women, that men, the attendance of men and the membership of men increases. I think that's documented. That doesn't prove it would happen with us, but it does. That's documented, I think. Yeah.
Within our church, we have a lay witness group, and it's composed of both men and women. Some husband and wife members, they do not go out as a team as husband and wife. The pastor's wife goes out with this lay witness group. They have found when they go to homes as lay witnesses, if it is two women going to a home to speak to a man and a wife about the possibility of them becoming members of the attending church, they do not have the response that they do if there is a male member in that lay witness group of two.
How about if there are two men?
Two men, fine. But if you have two women, they say that they have gotten the full shoulder so many times, and this witness group has been operating for 2 years, but they find that to be so often the case that if there's a man in the house, when two women come to speak to him, he will retire to another room. He will not even give him the courtesy of his feet. So they say they're much more effective if they are a man and a woman, or two men.
I've been looking upstairs. If anybody's got stuff to say up there, please wave or something. Yes, please.
Yeah, I think as far as the readying process, I don't know how much that's necessary, but I think one thing that's been positive over the past 2 years is the idea of, I really enjoy that lay people are being more and more involved in Lutheran services, and that's men and women. And I think that's a positive move as far as, you know, reading liturgy, doing the chanting, what, you know, any part of the service. Maybe that is helping some, I don't know. I would hope it is.
Someone else? Yes.
Yeah, it may not be what some of us or all of us want to hear, but I still think it boils down to a matter of time and experience. I happen to be in an industry, an executive in an industry where in the management area, in one particular aspect of this industry, it is traditionally male leadership. And I think that probably in the entire United States, and this is the third largest employer of people in the United States, that in our industry that we may have one of only about five in the United States females who head up that department. And this particular gal has been in charge of this department for about 4 years now. And, you know, does an outstanding job. And yet I have people come through on tours and consulting with us, and their first question is, how do you get by with that? How does that work? Because most of the people that she supervises are males.
I'm programmed to think that a male should be the minister. And I'm listening as we're talking about it, and there have been three times now in a conversation where the women have been referred to as girl or gal.
That's right.
And I wonder if we were talking about a man who was graduated, ready for a call, whether we would call him a boy.
No.
We would call him a guy, probably. I think, yeah, I think that's a hair splitting. I think you're looking for a mindset that doesn't exist.
Oh, I think it exists.
Well, we've got an issue, haven't we?
Language is an expression of the mindset that does exist. And it's very, very... We did exactly the same thing in the Civil Rights Movement. We went through a whole series of steps of changing language. And it was just indicative of a change of mind and mindset that was necessary.
It's a very easy out to say no. I mean, I just call them a gal or something, and they're grown.
I work for a human rights organization, and my boss continually calls the women in the office girls. It's just such a habit. It isn't that that's, you know, and I think there's still some mentality there. He doesn't call the men who are their boys, but the women are girls.
But he doesn't have any older women working for him.
Yes. We work in a large church with a lot of women in the support staff, and both the women and the men call themselves or the other gals from time to time. Or the girls. Well, the girls are going out for coffee today, one of the women will say.
You might be able to help them.
I think that's one place that the church can be really prophetic, and that is that I believe our the secular world has lost an understanding of the power and the mystery of the language that we use. It's just plastered everywhere. We hear it from televisions and radios, and everywhere we look, there are words. And in the secular world, I feel we don't understand what we understand in the church, and that is that the word has the power to create, and that the word not only reflects what we know to be true, but creates what is true. And in the especially in the Christian faith, creation by the Word, the incarnation of the Word is none other than God alive with us in Jesus the Christ, and in Christ as Christ comes over and over again. So I think it's probably one of the places that the church could be prophetic is to say we believe our faith speaks in such a way that does not permit us to use language carelessly or in a sloppy way or in a destructive way. Because as the story of the Tower of Babel points out, language destroys as well as creates and brings together. So I would think that a strong theology of the Word is a place where the church could be prophetic about this languaging of our faith and of one another. Because we create or destroy the people we are with by how we call them. And as George Orwell says in a beautiful article called The Politics of English Language, he says, when we murder somebody, we call them a nip or a jap or some demeaning term that says this is no longer a created child of God. He doesn't use created child of God, yeah. But to dehumanize the person. Yes. And that's basically what I think some of this language is the heart of what we believe. So as Christians, I think we need to use it with care.
Are you saying that gal and girl is dehumanizing to you?
Yeah. I'm saying when I'm called a girl, I no longer feel like a nearly 29-year-old woman. I feel like someone is calling me a child.
Yeah, so when somebody under 18, that's typically what girl is.
When you get 35, and you're maybe like,
call me boy anytime you want to.
My reference to Nancy, is that your name, Nancy?
Yes, yeah. Correct. Yeah.
We referred to Nancy as a girl or a gal in our discussions about her, but I want to reaffirm that we were most happy to have her. And in fact, the position that she was to occupy, if she had accepted it, became the permanent pastor position. And I don't find that at all difficult to accept either. So, whatever.
Okay. Yes, sir.
I think the matter of terminology is a problem. But I think it's we're learning as time goes along. And I kind of hope that the women will have some patience with us on that. We had a woman intern in our congregation, and that was a difficult, trying experience, I guess, for all of us. But it was a real learning experience, too. For example, she was quite angry most of the time, and she would correct us as pastors whenever we made a slip-up, so it was a time of learning, but it was a nerve-wracking experience because it was hard to give a sermon or even to talk without running into problems. Like, for example, I used the expression, "Man, what a beautiful day," and she said, "Don't use that word like that." And I used the word fellowship. And she said, that's a sexist term, fellow. And so she didn't like to use that term. And she had problems with the liturgy, of course. And I did too, except that it was there, and it would be difficult to change it on the spot. But whenever it wasn't changed, like the sons of God, we would quickly, when we would run into that term, change it to the children of God or the people of God. And this became nerve-wracking whenever we'd do some new piece of liturgy. If we didn't change it right there, afterwards we'd be called for it. And but through it all, it was a good learning experience because I got to know what it was that was disturbing, because sometimes we don't really know. And we discover that it is different with different women. So it's going to take time for them to settle down on what is really expected or wanted, and for us to get used to the new terminology. It'll come. It'll come with time, and I hope they keep up the pressure. In the meantime, I hope we can live in forgiving relationship not only with God, but with one another.
Please.
I think we're losing that forgiving relationship, though. I have a friend who I've had some long emotional discussions with about this. She cannot go to church anymore. I mean, she was brought up as a Lutheran. She went to Lutheran college, the whole bit. She can't go. The patriarchal images in church get her so hung up, she cannot relate to her faith. She can't relate to anything that's coming off of the pulpit or the liturgy. And I must say that I'm getting the same way. I can't find any women in my church who feel the same way that I do. All the women in my church, well, not all, but many of them are interested mostly in like serving weddings or serving funerals or being an LCW or whatever, which is fine. But there have to be options for other people too. And I think we have to move a lot faster than we're moving, because I think you're losing a lot of people. I think we're losing a lot of people.
Yeah. Over here and in there.
Dynamics of change. People who are comfortable really don't desire change. You are, when you are pushing for change, it's because you are very uncomfortable. And I think that's important to know, that you've got those two different things going on. We are all resistant to change if it is not something that is an improvement for us or something that makes our life better. So somehow there has to be that hearing of one another in the Christian community. And there are coming from two different kinds of ways. Those who are very comfortable with the way things are now, and those who are saying it's got to be different.
Martin Luther said someplace, I can't quote chapter and verse, but that any change in church or society must be preceded by and accompanied by a change in language. He's very clear on this, and that's just an aside. But I personally get very angry with women like the woman you were talking about, who say, I can no longer go to church because of the language. If indeed they're there because they heard the gospel and want to be part of the community of Christ, they heard that gospel by means of a scripture which generally has male-dominated language. And why that should alter with some kind of an awareness that all of a sudden, you know, some, they were included before. They were included with those words at their baptism. And I think that sometimes this language change stuff becomes either a cop-out or too a superficial thing. You know, I know a lot of young pastors who can, their language in terms of sexual inclusiveness is clean, pure, and, you know, noble. But that doesn't include me at all, because the content, a word is something that holds content. It's just a symbol. And the content of that word does not include me. They don't mean to include me. They mean to play the game. The game right now is to change your language to include people. Whereas I know a lot of pastors in their 60s who are wonderful preachers who use man, mankind, and all that language, and it includes me every time because the gospel is the content of that. And with my feminist friends about this over and over and over again, because I think that this is one point where the feminist movement has led the church down the garden path. You know, I think it's important that when addressing a group, you include everyone. You know, I'm not against inclusive language, but I think that we've really, you know, had problems.
Over here, Carol, did you have anything?
Yeah, also
with all their experience. I just came from an internship in Lubbock, Texas, which is not exactly what you call the feminist movement capital. and Lubbock is pretty much the buckle of the Bible Belt, I think. And I thought, well, I'll know what kind of interesting fights I'm going to have. And when I came in, the big issue among the churches, there were those that were very reluctant, or maybe thought they didn't know, they were going to wait and see and all that. Within about a week and a half, the real question arose as to whether or not my church, ALC, was going to be still cooperating with the local Missouri Synod Church in a midweek school. And it was the Missouri Synod Church that was questioning whether I was a threat to teach in midweek school because I might be older men. And suddenly my congregation rallied. It's almost like they needed an enemy or something. And they said, you have no right to criticize our intern if you're out of his hand. So maybe we need something to fight against.
Larry?
I wanted to say something to Nancy's point. I certainly appreciate it, and I would certainly concur that the content of the gospel is what we're trying to get at. It's church language. But it was a real eye-opener for me when a student this last year did a very serious study on the use of male gender terms as intended as inclusive language terms, like mankind, man, etc. And she did it in scripture text, she did it in hymns, she did it in theological treatises over several centuries. And what it came out to was that there was, in many cases, a very subtle, and sometimes not so subtle, but were cases where the authors really probably intended that to be inclusive language. It was not.
Yeah, no, that's true, right?
It was not. Again and again, there was a whole series of attributes that went along that, which were in turn associated with men. Even when the terms were used to mean male and female, the attributes there were characteristically men. And it was still a hierarchical, patriarchal world that was reflected. And so I don't think that was gospel. Now, and so when you made your statement, I think in many situations you would get applause from people who would not want to change the language. And much of that would be a reflection of keeping things in place.
But my point is that you can use a word to contain anything that it wants to. It's a hollow reason. Have you read Suzanne Langer? Do you read any linguists at all? The Philosophy and New Key, it's in there. Also, this book in bookstore called Walker Percy, The Message in the Bottle, which I would recommend. Yes. He uses that material a lot, but that whole thing, you know, and my point is that by the simple superficial changing of those words, doesn't change the thing.
Not the superficial changing.
No, but see, that's what's happened often. I mean, everything gets altered.
I agree with you. I'm not calling for a legalism.
Yeah.
You know, of a kind of okay vocabulary now.
Yeah.
But I just think unless you do have those changes, you in fact will not move very easily out of all a kind of set that's closely related to those words.
I agree with that.
Gentleman Beck.
Yeah, I think with the whole issue of language, I hear it here and I hear it so often. There seem to be two groups, a group of individuals who become very sensitive to the language and where exclusive language becomes rather painful, and another group which tends to say, but I don't see that it really matters. I mean, I think it's nitpicking. And I did an experiment for myself a couple of years ago in courses, and when I wrote my papers for courses, every time I wanted to use a generic pronoun, I used the feminine. And then I'd finish the papers, I'd hand them in, I'd get them back, and I'd read them, and I felt excluded from them. And I had wrote them. They were my thought. But always coming across she and her, I didn't find any identity in them. And I guess what that said to me is that women on the other side, constantly reading literature and listening to dialogue that uses male terms, women who have progressed to a place where they do feel excluded, that sort of exclusion becomes very painful. And I think for we as Christians, even if we can't perceive that it is that big a deal, even if we just can't in our own minds conceive of it as that, should respect the pain that some women are feeling. And I don't think all women, because all women aren't at a place where they're talking about wanting to change language. But enough of our sisters are there that I think we should respect the pain and the hurt they're going through and take that seriously enough to say, if they're asking us to change language, that maybe it's a very important step we should want to consider and move toward.
Thank you. Anyone else before Susan?
I agree with Sherman, and I think the place the church needs to start is with its theology. Martin Luther also said that we are to call a thing what it is. And by that, I believe he meant that when we call something by a name that is inappropriate, we are missing the truth of that thing. And, for instance, he said, if a preacher is preaching law and calling it gospel, we need to stand up and say, this is law, this is not gospel. And in many, many times when we say we are making peace by fighting war, someone needs to stand up and say, this is not making peace, this is waging war. So I think we need to start theologically calling a thing what it is, and that means we start with Scripture. We find out what it is Christ was preaching, what the kingdom of God is, what the presence of God fully with us is. And I think when we discover that, we find it is an inclusive presence, an all-embracing presence, presence in which there is no slave or free person. And if any of you were at Dan Erlander's presentation on early baptism, you know that there's a mouse running down the wall.
You saw it first.
I'm just saying that this language change, I agree with Nancy, if we just change language because it seems to be in or it's a political thing or the feminists are saying that we should, then that's the church is not being faithful to its task. And that's where I'd say I think language change is important, but I think I believe that because I've done the theological stuff with it first. And we need to call the presence of God what it is, and that is an all-embracing presence.
Over. I thought there was a hand back here. Yes.
When we talk about language changes, we're dealing with a couple of things, I think, in this context. One, the matter of gender, and another, the matter of semantics. I took enough Spanish, I guess, in junior high to say hola, Paco, que tal, but I also know that they were trying to teach us something about the gender, that the language and different words have definite gender and things like... And I guess things like in English that ships are she's and I don't know what is he, but anyhow, I think there's some of that built in to our way of thinking as human beings and as sexual beings. There is some of that built into the way we think. And I think when we start talking about the church, there's also a certain element of language usage that can be dismissed as being semantics. I know I ran into a brick wall the first time I met with some people from the church to evaluate me as a youth director when someone said, I don't know, something to the effect that, well, the church is a business and we have to be thinking about this if the numbers of kids involved in your program justify the cost. Now, I just blew up and I wrecked everything that I could have had with that committee. Because I just tore into them and up one side and down the other and blew my stack and told them what I thought and trying to prove to them that the church was not a business and that they had no right to call the church a business. But they do. If somebody wants to think of the church, and if somebody in their mind is trying to think of the Christian church or their local church, and the way they choose to think about it is as a business, then I can try to change their mind on that issue, but it boils down to semantics, and in the end, it doesn't, you know.
Except that when you say it boils down to semantics, that means to say, that sounds like, to me, like you're saying, call it what it is, it still remains the church. But
right.
What I'm saying is when we continually call the church a business, then our mindset becomes the church is a business. And we are not calling it what it is in truth, which is the body of Christ. And that's where, I mean, it's easy to say it's a matter of semantics, as if semantics didn't mean anything. When calling a church a business over and over gets into our minds that we're in the process of making money.
But I differ with you on that. It's very hard for me to say it's a matter of semantics and let someone call it a business. It cuts me up.
Yeah.
It hurts me.
Yeah.
But that's the way it is.
She seems to be disagreeing with your, that's the way it is. That's what, Mary.
I was just going to say the same thing. There are some people that still call blacks niggers. And you might say, well, that doesn't make any difference. They're still children of God. But I think that says that you think of them as less than you. And even though we started by calling them colored and then black, you know, maybe, I don't know which comes first, the change in language or the change in my thinking. But I think they both have to be there.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Here's a question here, please. Come on.
Does language change your thinking?
Does language?
I think the change of language changed my thinking, but I'm not sure that's true for everybody. I don't know.
A lot of people it doesn't. Okay. It's about 2 minutes. We have a couple comments. Anyone who hasn't spoken yet wants to get in before? Nance.
I'd like to say something to the group from my own situation, if I may.
Sure.
That's in talking about women clergy, as I hold the record right now for being the woman pastor in the ALC who's gone the longest without call. It's been over 2 years. And I can understand the sociological aspects of that. You know, that it's difficult to do something new, sociologically and emotionally. Where the real hurt comes, and I just like to say this to all of you so you can think about it, is that my church has said women may be pastors. My church also says its main calling is to preach the gospel. The American Lutheran Church in the United States and its other things is to be lively communities of Christ to preach the gospel and that word of justice and mercy and deeds of love, huh? And also at a time when churches, we're at a point where we need to marshal all our resources. It's becoming less and less easy to be a Christian and to be part of a church. And at the same time my church says all that, people are turning around to me and saying, we don't care if you're called to preach the gospel. We won't let you do it here. And I don't understand that. I'm real sorry. And that's real painful. You know, are we a church that wants everyone who's gifted to preach? Or are we going to say we want to know what the preacher looks like first? And I think that to say we want to know what the preacher looks like is an offense to the gospel.